You're listening to
Maine and Gray, the intersection of the city of God with the city of man, where we talk with interesting people doing interesting things out in God's world, and all for God's glory.
We'll probably talk to you more about pastoring and professoring and that kind of stuff.
Old Testament questions.
Yeah, right. Not necessarily the
archaeology
stuff. Right. And yet, you're an archaeologist living in Indiana. Do you, like, go home at night and watch Indiana Jones?
Right. Is that your... It's the great state to live in if you're an archaeologist. That's right.
Apparently so. Yeah. Is there a favorite Indiana Jones that you... is in?
Oh, the first one, of course.
Of course. Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right? That's right, exactly.
It's got
with the stone coming down the... fast, trying to chase him down the the tunnel. That's the great one.
I remember some line from one of them that said that 99% of archaeology is done in the library. Is that true?
I wish archaeologists did do a lot of library work. They like to dig, but they don't like to publish very much. They like to be out in the sun in the field, but we don't get a lot of their results till much later, often.
Which you've done a fair amount of over in Israel. You did a lot of archaeology over there.
Yeah, for sure.
What were some of the sites that you dug on?
Well, the first site I dug on, I've done, I think, five or six sites.
Wow. Okay.
So my first site, I was a college student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they use you as slave labor when you're a college student.
Right.
But I went to a site called Tel Kasila, which is a site right in the city of Tel Aviv. Mm. So you're digging this old mound with all these high rises around, and people are watching you with field glasses. Yeah. You know what you're doing down there.
Is he going to pull up a skull?
Right, exactly. and they had a field school there. Mm. So I was there for 6 weeks, and the main Israeli archaeologist would teach us things like how to read pottery, how to see the different layers in a mound or a tell, and all the ins and outs. So I was 20 years old and
cutting your teeth.
Exactly. Huh. Yeah. And so there were, I was in one section of this site in which there were three of us as students. One of the other students also became an archaeologist, teaches in a school in California. Hmm. So it was a lot of growing up together. It was a lot of fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So. How did you decide to get into archaeology? I mean, when you were, how old did you like, oh yeah, I want to dig?
So I was converted my first year of college.
Okay.
To Christianity. Mm. And I took a required class called Old Testament Survey, taught by Marvin Wilson.
What college was this?
It's Barrington College, which is merged with Gordon College, so they're one and the same.
Okay.
In New England. Mm-hmm. So, first day I went into that class, heard what Dr. Wilson did. I came out that day and knew what I wanted to do with my life, and it's never wavered all those years.
Cool.
So, God, that was a great gift.
Yeah.
Of God. I was a pre-med student, but I don't even like doctors. So
I don't think most doctors like doctors.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it was that. And then my undergrad major was in Bible, Old Testament, and Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Took a couple archaeology courses, went off to Gordon Conwell Seminary. Was there, they had what they called, they're interesting, they had what they called the BTI, Boston Theological Institute. So I could take courses at Harvard and lots of different schools, BU, Boston College, whatever, in Boston. So I went down there, took Egyptian under Lambden, took Aramaic, took a lot of the languages. Yeah. Then when I went off for my PhD work, if you want to be a professor, there are three in Old Testament. There are three things you can do. Mm-hmm. You can go language to study Hebrew and Aramaic and whatever. You can do history, or you can do archaeology. History is dangerous because certain schools are very liberal, and it's a bad way to go.
Right.
Language is language, you know. Yeah. You're going to end up writing a dissertation on a verb or something, but that just didn't interest me. Now, archaeology was great because you go dig, you find something new.
Yeah.
So right away you have your...
There's your dissertation.
There's your dissertation. So it made it much easier. Now, it made it harder because you had to be overseas a lot.
Right.
And so I was excavating through
out in the sun.
Absolutely.
Wearing those big sun hats to try Absolutely. Not get sunburned.
Absolutely.
What did you do your dissertation on? I've looked it up. But.
It's ancient agriculture. So,
scintillating.
Yeah, really. So when I would lead trips to Israel, people asked me what kind of tree that is. I'd go, I have absolutely no idea. I wrote my dissertation on, on it, but I don't know what that grain is or whatever.
Right,
so,
right.
There you go. Typical. Yeah.
So you went to University of Chicago.
I did.
What was the time there like?
It was good in learning, but it was a very difficult program. So there, you're required to do 2 years of classwork, then you take your first set of exams, and then you do two more years of classwork and take your final set of exams, and then you write your dissertation and do an oral exam. And it's in 9 areas. So you have Egypt, Palestine or Israel, and Mesopotamia, and you have to do language, history, and archaeology of all 3 areas that give exams.
Wow.
But so I started with 14. I was the only one who made it.
Well,
I think it comes down to just grit or being a mean person or something that you make it through.
Stubborn, at least.
Yeah, stubborn. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So you did language. What languages did you have to do? Egyptian?
I did Aramaic, Hebrew, Ugaritic, which is Canaanite. I did some Akkadian, as well as Latin and Greek.
Yeah, the normal ones.
And then, of course, you have to do French and
German.
So.
That's amazing because that's just the language part. That's not even the actual material itself. That's just
Correct.
How languages work.
Correct. And the German and French is for research. Mm-hmm. You have to know what those guys are writing. And the German one was good because I had German in college and so forth. The French one, I didn't know a word of French. We was about it. And so they would give you 3 shots at it.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you come in and you take an hour-long test. They give you a passage, you have a dictionary, and then you would have to try and translate what you could within an hour, but it's really difficult.
Yeah.
I went in knowing nothing, but I wanted to see what it was like so I could make sure I prepare myself well for it. So I get into the exam and I start with the dictionary translating. I'm going, I know this passage.
Oh.
It was from 2 Samuel.
Oh,
I mean, I was expecting an archaeology passage or a scientific second sample, and went right through it. And my my advisor said to me later, "You got the highest grade on French exam in the history of this institution."
Oh, wow!
But I didn't
context
know
context helps so much.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's like a lesson for.
It was another grace that came.
Yeah, exactly.
From the Lord. Yeah.
So you were at the University of Chicago, and you told me earlier that you submitted your dissertation to, well, at least not for approval or for reading, but for. I forget the term, but you said you met Kate Turabian.
No, I met Kate Turabian, and her number one student was what was called the dissertation secretary at Chicago.
Yes.
So what you do is when you finish your dissertation and went through all the professors and you got all that and got it basically approved, you had to take it to the dissertation secretary.
Yeah.
Which was like going to the dentist.
Yeah,
And so you walk in, and she had this little room downstairs in the administration building, you know, and you'd walk down the halls, and all the pipes are in the ceilings, you know. It was all tiled, and so we go in, and I go in, and I'm by myself. And there's a counter that you walk up to, and her desk is behind the counter.
Okay.
And so I walk up, and she's doing something at her desk. Mm-hmm. She looks at me, and she goes, "You have a dissertation." I said, "Yes." She said, "Put it on the counter."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Okay." And then she walks up and she turns it. I mean, very precise.
Well, of course.
And then she goes,
page by page.
And you're sitting there and the sweat's starting to go down. And she turned to me and she said, "You typed this yourself, didn't you?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "I can tell."
Oh, okay.
And then she said to me, "You know, it's kind of like banking. You take care of your money better than somebody else does."
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was great advice. So
that's awesome.
Got approved.
What year was that, if I can ask?
So it was done in 86.
Oh, wow.
So 1986.
Still there. Okay. For those that don't know, Kate Turabian, for people that have been through seminary, that would be like shaking Sinatra's hand. I mean, she, you know, as far as guidelines go, everything has to be in her format, Chicago stuff.
Right.
So she's kind of famous for those of us that have had to write papers and theses and things like that.
It was one of the terror ridden acts that you had to go through to get approved.
Was she cordial at all? I mean, did she warm
well
up
she
after,
had, she yeah. had retired at that point, so it was just her number one student who was doing that. But it wasn't, the nut wasn't far from the tree.
Yeah,
so
that's funny.
Yeah,
that's cool. So archaeology, you spent a lot of years doing some digs. You were, one of your positions was at a university in Israel, or a center for digging.
Right.
For
archaeology. So the Jerusalem Center for Biblical Studies,
there it is.
And we dug at Bethsaida, which is a New Testament site on the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah.
Where. Jesus healed a blind man there in Mark chapter 8, and the feeding of the 5,000 was right next to Bethsaida. Mm-hmm. It was one of the sites where Jesus talked about the people having not repented there. Yeah. Woe to you, Bethsaida, woe to you, Capernaum. So it was one of those sites. And we were there three or four seasons with RTS students, so it was a lot of fun we had there. Yeah.
What do you think? How has that contributed to the work of what God is doing in the church? How does archaeology help? You know what Jesus is doing, building the church.
Yeah, I think it's helpful for our understanding of the Bible, in the sense of it gives us the earthiness.
Yeah.
To the scriptures, gives us an understanding how things work. So when we were at Bethsaida, the level we were digging on was New Testament level. And so my group that I was overseeing.
So that, just want to back up a second. That means the layer down in dirt.
Correct.
Was New Testament level.
Yes,
so
correct.
You weren't digging down Old Testament times.
No, that was, that's right.
It was a few feet below.
Yes, correct.
Okay, got it.
And so we were digging in the domestic quarter, which would be the houses and so forth, from the New Testament period. And Bethsaida was the home to Peter, Andrew, and Philip.
Yeah.
And so students would say, you think we're digging in Peter's house? I'd say, well, if you find a mailbox that says Peter on it, yes, that's where we are. Right. Otherwise, what we were finding was a lot of fishing gear and all those different types of things. These men were fishermen.
Yeah.
So it helps us understand what their housing was like. How did they fish, their different implements, what type of food did they eat, different things like that. So it's helpful to fill in our understanding of the scriptures that way.
Yeah, it kind of shows you the importance of the scene, you know, the way Jesus talked about things, the way he would talk about fishing, right?
Right.
I mean, even performing a miracle with a fish and multiple fish and things like that. So it does kind of get you brings it to life a little bit. It doesn't. It's not like we were waiting for confirmation of the truth. So like, that's right. Okay, the Bible said Peter was a fisherman, so now we know.
Right.
But it does help us understand a little bit of the context of.
Yeah. I mean, you'd read something like in Joshua chapter 2 where it talks about, it says Rahab lived in the wall of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And you're reading that, and you just keep going. But you're like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, we found that through excavation, that the outer walls of the city of Jericho were hollow. Hmm. And they were used as the back rooms of houses going around the city. And when there was great threats, they would fill in those hollow rooms with boulders and different things like that. So she actually did live in the wall.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It had a window of some kind.
Yeah, exactly, for the men to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it helps us, gives us some deeper insight to what's going on.
Yeah, I think we can tend to, just accidentally be Gnostics where we think, like, this is all spiritual stuff. And I think perhaps archaeology kind of brings it down to earth where it's like, dust. This is real. We are made of dust, and so were the people thousands of years ago.
Absolutely.
It was real people doing real things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've heard it said that archaeology is really looking at a lot of trash. Did you dig up a lot of trash? Like,
yeah,
trash tells us a lot about a society.
Well, right. It's the science of garbage.
Yeah.
Really, because everything's broken and all the walls are knocked down. Right. So all you're dealing with is foundations of buildings and you're dealing with pottery that's all broken and so forth. You very rarely find something complete.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to reconstruct it from what you have found. Now, when they found the Ebla tablets up in Syria in the 1970s, they were really smart about it because they hit the library and all of the tablets were strewn. And what they ended up doing was putting them all back on the shelf as they had fallen.
Oh, wow.
And they found numerous stories that went from one tablet to another. So they had them in order.
They kept them in order.
Yeah. So
what layer down was that as far as timing
goes? That was very early. Yeah. That's one of the earliest languages is Eblaite.
Yeah. Okay.
We're still learning it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Isn't it? Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, that's really cool. What are some of the trends in archaeology now? I mean, like how has the field expanded or gotten better or gotten worse since, you were out there in the sun doing doing all those digs?
Well, in some ways it's gotten better because it's become much more scientific. So you bring in all areas of science in our understanding. Mm-hmm. So you bring in, you find a burial, you bring in a bone guy and he'll study the burial or whatever and tell you. So you're bringing in all the different...
Oh, this was a femur or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You're bringing in. So all that's really good. So it's multidisciplinary now. Where it used to be kind of the way, it used to be Indiana Jones treasure hunting.
Yeah.
But we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
I think like everything else, the weakness is... I don't put this in a good way. Archaeology is being affected by progressive trends, if I can say that.
Sure.
So, for example, there was a story, and it's a true story, of a professor at a university. They were looking at a skeleton in a class, and he said, "Oh, we can't tell what gender it is, so you can't say it's a male body or a female body." And all the students were just laughing because they could see that the body was female. They knew it was female.
Right.
But that's all, all of a sudden you're...
Interesting.
Isn't it?
Wow.
So even gender studies is hitting things like archaeology.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you can't even make a statement about something that was thousands of years ago.
Right. Correct.
Because of our current milieu.
Right. Correct. And so there's even started on the internet underground archaeology sites.
Kind of a play on words.
Yeah, really. Where archaeologists anonymously say, "I found this and it's a male, 35 years old, blah, 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 blah." But they can't.
Can't identify yourself.
Yeah, can't identify yourself. Because
even though they're tenured? I mean.
Yes, because. We don't know how they identified themselves. I mean, that's the argument.
Pretty
and
sure.
You're
we
like,
do,
I think we do.
Yeah,
exactly. So, so you're dealing with that.
Wow.
I think you're dealing with that with almost every field of study.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's critical theory. I mean, you're going to look.
Right.
You're going to take this lens.
Yep.
And look at everything that way.
Exactly.
Even something that was that lens wasn't invented yet.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Thousands of years ago.
Right. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah, so that really affects publishing too, because if you say something wrong, you're not going to get something published
or
in a journal.
Yeah, correct.
Wow, did you face any of that, or when you were writing, or was it?
No, mine was much more dealing with historicity issues, because of course I held to history of the scriptures, you're going to bang right into it there with the archaeological elite primarily are quite liberal when it comes to those issues. So they'd be what we would term minimalistic, where I would be a maximalist, where I would see that scripture and archaeology go together, and that's how we work it.
And so they're
they would be very
minimal. How? Like, what is that?
Well, they would say that you can't trust what's being said in the scriptures as being historical.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's kind of funny to think that the current trends of our society are as being read back on previous societies. It doesn't seem to, in a way, it doesn't seem to do justice to the previous societies. It's kind of unfair.
Right. Correct.
You know, they weren't thinking what we were thinking.
Correct. Correct. And so that's why also you get, when you get, for example, when ISIS came through Iraq and so forth, they destroyed archaeological sites because they wanted to deny that history. They even killed some archaeologists.
Oh, wow. Very Indiana Jones.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of like tearing down statues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you tear down everything that is historical, good or bad. But, I mean, you know, it's our history. We need to deal with it, but not that way.
Yeah.
Cancellation.
Yeah. Right. Getting rid of it doesn't help us not repeat it, at least.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow, that's sad. So you've written a number of books and commentary on Exodus. I think you just finished a commentary on Joshua, or it's not published yet.
No, it got submitted to Erdman's, Pillar Commentary Series, which is a famous New Testament series.
Right.
Edited by Carson.
Carson's the editor for New Testament.
Yep. Right. And so they decided to do one for the Old Testament.
Okay.
And the queue is lining up. None of them have been published yet.
Oh, okay.
I'm in the early part of the queue. They thought Joshua was an important book. I think they're going to do Genesis, Joshua, and maybe Psalms are going to be the lead.
Okay.
Lead
That's
ones.
Exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. Yeah. So
when's that due out?
Who knows?
It's still in the editing process?
Or? Yeah. Oh, yeah. They have it. And that course takes time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They come back and say, you got to redo this, and so that takes time. Yeah. And then you got to do your indices and all that kind of stuff. So,
and I'm sure you typed your own footnotes.
Of course.
Of course you did this yourself.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I did.
Yeah. That's cool. And then you wrote a book on the interacted between Egypt and the Old Testament, if I recall right. What was the title of that
That's
one?
Correct. Ancient Egypt and the Old Testament Ancient for Egypt. Baker.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And then one somewhat more recent, but Against the Gods, which I happen to have a copy of here, which is really fun. Good read. The polemical theology of the Old Testament. Explain a little bit for our listeners. What is polemical theology? How does the old scripture? How does the Old Testament make a polemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. For my many years of teaching, one of the issues that people want to deal with is they'll say, "Well, you have like the Ark account in Genesis, but we have an ark account in Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
How can that be?"
Yeah.
And so the common argument is, well, the Bible guys, they stole it from and then cleaned it up and made it Yahwistic or something like that. And then you have a lot of creation accounts that show some similarities to what we have in Genesis chapter 1. And again, they're trying to argue for plagiarism or borrowing, they would call it. I'd call it plagiarism. They'd call it borrowing.
Yeah.
But as I dealt with that, I felt like there's another answer, not to all of those, but one of the ways that we can perhaps look at it is that the biblical authors weren't accepting the accounts from Mesopotamia or Egypt or whatever, but in fact they were playing off of those accounts.
Okay.
So if you look at the Ark account, Utnapishtim in Mesopotamia, polytheism, many gods, magic is the primary issue, so forth and so on. But then you look at the Ark account in the Bible, those things aren't even there. I mean, the real issue of the Ark account, the one thing you find in the Ark account that you don't find in any other Ark episode in the ancient Near East is the covenant. So right. The point was, yes. And so when I look at it, I say, okay, in Mesopotamia, you have these Ark accounts. And how are we to understand that? Does that undercut the Noahic account? No. It says there was a Ark incident.
Yeah.
But, excuse this language, but this is typical language, the Mesopotamians bastardized the truth.
Yeah.
Okay. And then Scripture reveals the truth to us of that account. So actually, I look at it in a more positive way, that it shows us that there was a flood in those other accounts. But the Hebrews understood it as it happened and then in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't, these other accounts don't undermine the the Old Testament, as some critical scholars would say. In a way, it actually shows, no, this did happen.
Correct.
Right. And so when the Old Testament writers were writing, they were using it, their material, as kind of as an argument against all these other secular, pagan myths.
Yeah, correct.
Right. So there's more history in the Old Testament and then more mythology and some of the other, in the pagan writings.
And so our more moderate liberal friends would want to say, well, because we have a creation account, Mesopotamia is a mythic, therefore Genesis 1 would be mythic. And I'd say, no, you've got that backwards.
Right. It just shows the presuppositions. If you're going to a priori write off what the Old Testament said, then of course you're not going to believe what the Old Testament said.
Right.
Because you've already written it off.
Correct.
Right. But if you assume that it's true, then you're going to get a certain certain interpretation. Yeah.
So a lot of scholars underscore the similarities.
Mm-hmm.
And I underscore the dissimilarities.
Yes, I picked that up, yeah.
These are purposeful and foundational to the Hebrew world and life view over against the pagan mythological.
Yeah, so the differences emphasize the uniqueness of what was going on in Israel.
Correct.
That Israel was a firstborn, chosen by God.
Correct.
And he was sanctifying them, making a nation for himself.
Right.
The differences.
Right.
Yeah, so let's get an example. I was thinking in your book you talked about Moses and the story of Horus, you know, the persecuted child.
Yes.
Right, and so the critical scholars would say, oh, well, that's just borrowing.
Right.
But you're saying that, no, this was Moses writing, explaining what actually happened.
Yes.
And it shows that God was doing something in his sovereign plan.
Yes. And would Moses know the story of Horus?
Yeah.
Well, he was, Stephen says he was trained in all the ways of the Egyptians.
Yeah.
So he knew their language, he knew all their history, he knew all their stories, and so forth and so on. And God in his providence brought Moses. In other words, what was myth in Egypt became history in Israel.
Right. His mother could have known, too. I mean, she could have known about Horus and said, oh, hey, that's a great idea. Let me put him in a reed basket.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's like, I'm looking for a plan. Oh, here's a plan.
Right,
and then draw Moses out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the differences are really important, and I think that's probably what critical scholars are missing.
Right. And it goes back to C.S. Lewis, who had he used to talk about myth became fact.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So that was really a driving force in the way that I was trying to understand the relationship.
Yeah, and you said that phrase a number of times, and I kept thinking, oh, C.S. Lewis, and part of Lewis's thinking, as you know, was, all of these myths are out there, and then when we get special revelation from God, it kind of takes all of those myths and says, oh, there were some elements of truth to them. At least they pointed to the truth.
Right.
And now here's the truth.
Absolutely.
So the myth became the fact. And I think perhaps that's what happened with all of these, flood myths.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, these all these other ideas out there. And then God said, no, it's time. Now you know the truth.
Yes.
And he gave the gave the truth.
I think that's correct.
Truth to Israel.
Yeah. I think that's correct.
And I think, talk about the differences between the God of the Old Testament and the gods in these myths. You went into this in your book a fair amount. They're quite different.
Yes.
Yahweh was very different than these other gods.
Yes. So the gods of the ancient Near East are, first of all, there are many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Egyptian gods are everywhere. If you go to the British Museum, go to the different galleries of Egyptian gods, you see they worshipped the monkey, they worshipped alligators, mm-hmm. Crocodiles, they worshipped monkeys and cats and, you know, all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so their gods were personified in the very elements of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So their main god was Ra, or Re, who's the sun god. He's personified in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Not so the Lord. What's he personified in? No, yeah. Right? He created the sun.
Yeah.
He created the monkey. He created the cat. He all those different types of things. So what we see in the scriptures is the exaltation of who God really is.
Sure.
Rather than his being part of nature. The gods of the ancient Near East often just act like humans. They get mad, they have parties, the whole bit. But what kind of god is that, right?
I don't want a god that's like me.
Yeah, right, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So, John says in the Apocalypse that he's worthy of our worship because he created all things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the transcendence of God. Now there's a difference with the immanence of God. That is, he works in and throughout his creation. Not so like the Egyptian gods.
Mm-hmm.
Man is a slave and, he's not worthy of you don't pray to them or different things like that. So there's that lack of relationship. There's no covenant. I mean, covenant is all about relationship between the Lord and his people.
Yeah.
You don't find those.
So it's really unique.
It's all real different.
Yeah.
Right?
Even when they're attempting to make transcendent statements, like explaining where the world came from, where cosmogony and everything, even the gods are still pretty crass and doing weird, foolish things.
Oh, yeah.
It's just odd.
Impregnated...
I forget what exactly some of the examples, but just very odd ways of that the world came into existence,
right?
That aren't very appealing. But I mean, you kind of think about it, that they were doing their best in a darkened by sin way, explaining what they were seeing, or like this is how humans are made, so maybe this is how the world was formed, and, and this is what we heard from our ancestors for 500 years. So, I mean, they were taking a stab at it. Again, C.S. Lewis, myth became fact.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that fits with things like. These people were sacrificing.
Mm-hmm.
It shows there was something inherent in them that they needed to do that.
Yeah.
But it was all man-made mm-hmm. and twisted, right?
Yeah.
So it was inherent to us that we would give honor to a god.
Something.
Yes.
Something bigger.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Hmm. One thing you didn't go into in the book, and I was kind of curious, and I could be wrong about this, but it's and I can understand why you didn't bring it up, was the bronze serpent in the history of Israel. In a way, that could have been, I think you actually did bring it up in your Ancient Egypt and the Old Testament book. That was kind of a polemic against Egypt as well.
Correct.
So the people of Israel about to enter the Promised Land, and so Moses was telling them all of these things, and Moses needed to convince is the wrong word, but you get the idea. They're trying to show the people of Israel that what was going on in Egypt was not right. It was not what God wanted for them.
Right.
The serpent was on the head of Pharaoh. I mean, it was a revered
on his crown.
His crown.
Yeah.
And then it became this curse to them. So you had to wonder if they were thinking, oh, the gods of Egypt are getting back at us for leaving.
Right.
And then Moses lifted up this bronze serpent. I think in your book you interpreted that as Moses showing, no, Yahweh is in charge of even the serpents.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I would argue that those are cobras. And the sign of the cobra for Pharaoh was his power and his sovereignty.
Yeah.
That's why he had it on his crown. It was right on the front.
Yeah.
You know, showed his. And and ironically, the people of Israel, they're out in the wilderness. They want to go back to Egypt. So God says, you want Egypt? Let me show you what Egypt is.
Yeah.
And then they get hit with all the cobras.
Mm-hmm.
And then, ironically, God then heals them through this this cobra on a on a pole. I mean, it just shows that God was in charge of all these different types of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it glorifies him.
Right. And even that was an act of faith. They look up to this
correct.
To this serpent.
And of course, John 3, that all points to Christ and his death upon the cross.
Yeah, the Son of Man must be lifted up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk for a minute about Moses' staff. This was super interesting in the book. You made the case that it was a shepherd's staff.
Yes.
It had a crook in it.
Yes.
And that was represented in the hieroglyphics. Was I right about that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So talk about the idea of the staff and how that represented power in ancient Egypt and in the Old Testament.
Sure. So the big episode is the Egyptian magicians against
the
Moses
throwdown.
And Aaron. Yeah, the throwdown is what it was.
Yeah.
And if you ever saw Prince of Egypt, in that scene where Moses faces the Egyptian magicians, the song is "Now you're playing with the big boys," which was really good in that movie. So the rod and staff for the Egyptians was their sign of divine power being imbued in the rod itself.
Okay.
They actually believed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gave them sovereign power in their magic to do all sorts of things against nature.
Whoever held this rod had the power.
Right. And so then you see this rod that was given to Moses. They go, he and Aaron going to face down the magicians. That Aaron's rod ends up swallowing the rods of the Egyptian magicians. And the point being, God's sovereignty swallows Pharaoh's sovereignty. Or
they're playing
Egyptian.
With the big boy now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I think it's easy to skim over that, you know, because we don't know the context. And again, this is where perhaps history and archaeology and hieroglyphics help us out a little bit because it gives us the context. And know that this staff, these rods were important for power.
Absolutely.
You know, we think of Gandalf and the Lord of the Rings and perhaps Harry Potter, and you have these magic wands. So it's not too hard to imagine, but power was symbolized in,
these
rods, and God's power overcame the...
Yeah. And then they used the rod throughout the plagues to show God, it's God's power, Yahweh's power that's doing these things. It's not Moses, it's not Aaron.
Yeah, this just came to me. Moses striking the rock. I mean, kind of insult. It's kind of an insult because it's, you know, God said speak to it, and
he hits it.
In his anger, he hits it.
Yeah,
and that had a lot of symbolism because of it was a rod.
Yes, exactly.
God wanted his voice, the voice to do it, not or spoken words to bring the water out.
Yeah,
not the hitting of the rod of the rock. Hmm. It really seems like archaeology, you know, just listening to what you've been saying, is that it does a lot for what goes on in the inside of the church. It helps a secular field. We would tend to think, it does good things out there in the world, whatever.
Yeah.
But in a way, this is something that's going on that you were doing out there that really has helped the church, helps people's faith, helps them understand what's going on in Scripture.
Right.
So it's kind of this neat reverse thing. Often we think that, you know, Christians go out in the world and help what's going on out there. We do good deeds and acts of mercy and kindness and build a society. But in a way, a secular field is kind of helping the work of the church.
Right. I mean, it's an apologetic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is helpful for us in the church.
Yeah.
It's also, I would argue, an apologetic to the scholarly world that they need to really look at this stuff and see the earthiness of this. It really helps us, again, set biblical events in time and place and in history. I mean, we're in an age where these couple generations, I don't even know what they are now, Z and whatever.
We're back to the A's.
Right. Are really against history. It has no meaning or purpose or anything like that.
It's all inaccurate.
But it does, because we serve a God of history, a God who started things and bringing them to the end. What is that? That's history. Mm-hmm. It's his story, I mean, people would say. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely correct. So that's why it's really important.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul said, if Christ did not die in time and place in history, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die.
Right.
It just underscores.
Be a materialist.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, it does. It does underscore the history of, I mean, this sounds trite, history of reality, right? This is the real thing. This is what has happened, and God has told us what has
Correct.
Happened. And even
right.
when we see a conflict between what we, you know, what a secular field of critical scholarship is telling us, we can wait. We can wait a few years, a few decades. We're going to be right.
Yes, we can. Absolutely.
it's happened time and time again.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, right. I don't know how that squares, but
right.
give me a couple of decades and
right.
and we'll figure it out. Yeah, it's cool. It just shows that God's in control.
Yes.
He's sovereign even over the secular trends and things like that. So what's next? What's next for you, writing and scholarship and professoring?
Yes. Well, I'm writing a commentary on Haggai.
Oh, yes.
There's a new series coming out with Crossway on the Reformed exegetical commentary series.
Okay.
So I thought, well, this is going to be easy. It's only two chapters.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I remember I was preaching a sermon in Zechariah once, and I thought, Zechariah is an incredible book, it's so complicated. And I pulled up, I can't remember the author. Anyway, one commentary, over 1,000 pages, right? And I'm just like, oh, man, this is going to take forever to some of these minor prophets.
Yeah, and so it's only 38 verses. I'm on verse maybe 20 out of 38,
okay.
and it's already 120 pages. And I haven't done any of the introductory work.
Oh, yeah.
This is just all commentary.
This is just technical stuff.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you feel like commentaries these days want to be exhaustive, but I don't take it that way.
Okay.
I want to give clarity and brevity that are helpful to the reader, okay? Yeah. Rather than give them absolutely everything.
For those of us using the commentary,
right, exactly. And so it's a commentary. It's not everything. It's not a book about everything about Haggai that's ever been written in history. Mm-hmm. You just can't, shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But you want to provide something that's very helpful to the church and to teachers and pastors and laymen who want to study that book.
Yeah. What's your writing process like? Do you do tons of research first, or do you research as you go? Do you write every Monday?
Write
Maya Angelou, you go to a hotel and you write in a hotel?
No. I try to write almost every day except for Sunday. Do 2 or 3 hours.
Okay.
Maybe more in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then put it down. But just consistent.
Yeah.
My personality is such as if I went away from it for a while, I may not go back to it. So I just have to keep the train going down the track. The Lord's been very good about that. When I wrote my commentaries on the Torah, I would do one verse a day, no matter what it was. If it was, and Moses said, that's all I did that day.
Yeah.
But then if I got to hardening of the heart, that'd be a long day.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going to finish that particular verse.
Yeah.
And it just...
Yeah.
And that series is 7 volumes, so you just kind of stick with it. And,
wow. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
When's Haggai due, or when's the manuscript due at least?
I think they want one chapter at the end of the summer,
okay,
in order to assess, to make sure I'm going the right way.
Yeah.
And then that's due in end of 2026. So I got 2 years to finish it off.
Oh, okay. 2 years.
Only 18 verses to go.
So, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I find that the shorter books are more problematic because you have to figure everything in between that's not there. Plus, it's a short series. I mean, Haggai only preached for, 4 months or 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
That's the whole series. So I look at it as a series of preaching by the prophet to the people. And so I break it down that way as a series of sermons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully that'll be helpful to the church.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. Way. What are you doing teaching wise? What's your load these days?
It's an odd situation. I'm a full-time faculty member at RTS Dallas. Right.
He's not retired, folks. In case you thought he's retired. He's not. Full-time.
I'm full-time voting faculty member.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we go down there, and we just came back. We go down there for 3 months, mid-January to mid-April, and I do all my teaching there. I did 3 courses.
Okay.
And then I go back for a week in October to do a 1 week intensive. So I get all my teaching done in that time.
Okay.
Then the rest of the time we're in Indiana writing. I'll teach at Indianapolis Theological Seminary one course a year. Do some preaching for Christ Community and
class
and
or
so
two
forth.
Here if you're gonna,
yeah, right, yeah, exactly. That's it.
Yeah.
So
And then you'll do intensives at other campuses, right? I mean, you did a DMIN intensive in Orlando.
Yes, so I've done those.
Every once in a while, you'll have to do those.
We're gonna, well, we're gonna have to see how that's gonna work with the Dallas gig.
Yeah,
they're trying to really get going there,
and
so my teaching time they'd really like me to do. If I'm gonna do it in Dallas.
Do it in Dallas. Yeah, that makes sense because that is your campus.
Right. Correct.
Yeah, and that's the third campus then for you, because you did Jackson.
Started in Jackson.
Did Charlotte for a number of years.
I think it was 14.
Yeah.
We did. I first started at Grove City.
Right.
Taught there for 14 years. Jackson 14, and I think Charlotte 14. So it's kind of like Moses.
Oh, yeah.
He's got this 40, 40, 40. I've got a 14, 14, 14. Yeah.
Or the genealogy of Christ is 14 generations.
Yeah, right. Yes. Exactly. That's right.
So you're not slowing down. I love it. You said you were saying better to burn out than rust out.
Yeah, that's old Whitfield said that.
Whitfield said
that. Yeah, it's better.
Yeah, you don't want to slow down.
Yeah.
That's great.
So no retirement in the Bible, except for the Levites get to retire at 50. But 50 back then was the old 70.
You don't have many years left.
That's right.
You don't have any teeth left.
That's right, exactly.
Dentistry.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's good. Well, I know we've benefited a lot from your ministry around here, and obviously use your books often and look forward to the Haggai commentary. Just keep up the good work. Give Nancy a big round of gratitude for lending your gifts to the church and to RTS as well. We're all very grateful.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it. Main and Gray is brought to you by Christ Community Church of Carmel, Indiana, at the corner of Main Street and Gray Road. If you're looking for a church home or just visiting the Indianapolis area, stop in and say hi. We'd love to get to know you. Until then, God bless.